Welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Ryan Bailey, and today we are answering the question, what would a podcast that answers your question sound like? Joining me to do so is a man who, much like Karen Benzema, Mats Hummels and Thomas Müller, is very welcome to sit at the top table of soccer, Taylor Rockwell.
Hello, the top table of soccer. That's exciting. I assume that was going to be all players who might be at the Euros this summer, but I'll take top table instead.
They are all indeed players who may or may not be at the Euros, who've been welcomed back into the fold. I will say, Taylor, you've yet to be exiled by anybody so far, so you're doing better than those guys, I guess.
I mean, so far. We'll see how this show goes and then all the other shows to follow.
There's time. Joining Taylor and I is a man who's busier digging into the numbers than Harry Kane's agent right now. It's Joe Lowry.
Oh, I'm going to take that. I think that's flattering to me, but Ryan, thank you as always for the flattering introduction.
Of course, Joe. Of course, you're very welcome. And let's get the prediction straight off the bat. Harry Kane next season. Where? Now? Go.
Harry Kane will be joining my summer men's league team. I'd like to be the first to announce that. We really need some quality. And I think Harry, we're going to stick him at center back because I'm going to stick everybody at center back. But we're delighted to have him for sure.
I would pay so much money to see Harry Kane try to survive a summer in Arizona. That would be a reality show I would watch. He would just be permanently covered in sunblock. Dip him into a vat of sunblock like Achilles, and then they just have to worry about that heat.
It's all or nothing, but it's just one cameraman following around Harry Kane for a summer in the desert. That's great.
I'd like to see that. Who would your manager be in that team? I think Jose would be good.
Oh, yeah. No, he's not going to Roma. He's not going to Roma. He's coming out here.
Is Roma the name of your HOA in Phoenix?
Yes, it is. Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Did I get mistaken for that?
I like that we're starting off by going incredibly niche right from the jump. Let's do this. Let's go even, Joe, we need to know more about your local housing ordinances, if you don't mind.
Oh, that's for a future show, Taylor. Come on, I can't spill all the beans right now. We've got work to do.
That's fair. We do.
I feel like we started off pretty broad talking about Harry Kane and world-class players, but hey, we went down that tunnel pretty quickly is what I'll say.
Yeah.
This is, as I mentioned, a listener question show. Thank you to everybody who has submitted them. What say you, boys? Shall we get into it?
Let's do it.
We shall. I'm still trying to figure out where I would like to be exiled if I were going to be exiled. Like, are we talking, am I like adrift on an iceberg? Is that the level of exile we're talking, or do I just have to go to another state or country?
Like a Napoleon Island or something. How about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, exactly. You can send me to Iceland. I'll go to Iceland. That's fine.
That sounds fun. Yeah. Right. Iceland. Oh, yeah. The original island. I like that.
Indeed. <Very good. laughs> The original island. The first.
Apart from Ireland as well. Maybe
that the OG Iceland. Yeah.
Lots of islands named after the word island. Interesting.
Interesting.
Not really interesting. Should we get into the questions? Here's one from Tyler Kinshella. Thank you very much, Tyler. With the super unfortunate injury to Aaron Long, is it Chris Richards' time for the USMNT? It's Richards' time. Or is it? I don't know. Taylor, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it probably is. I don't know about the musical number accompanying it, but I would like that to be a feature as well.
What's wrong with it?
Oh, just I don't know if we're going to play that every time he comes in. Is that his entrance
we
music?
Are now.
Is that playing the whole time he's playing? I mean, yeah, I think we probably have to. We should probably clip that one and keep it for posterity. I think it is probably his position to lose, maybe battling Matt Miazga. I do think a lot of it will depend on John Brooks being healthy. Not that he wouldn't be, but if he's there, I think that gives you a lot of veteran stability to be able to play a less experienced center back. But if John Brooks were hurt or weren't able to participate, then maybe Berhalter goes with a more kind of veteran pairing, even if they're not of the same quality.
So Aaron Long obviously got an Achilles injury, ruptured Achilles tendon, in fact. That's a season ender. Bad news for Red Bulls and bad news for the USMNT as well. A bit of a shame for a player. He's got a really good story, hasn't he? Sort of rising from the ranks to captain his country. Very, very impressive stuff. Joe, what do you make of this one? It seems like there are some other potential. It might not be Chris Richards' time necessarily. As we mentioned, we've got Matt Miazga in the picture. Walker Zimmerman, is he?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a bunch. Like a little bunch of center backs. Imagine it like a grape stem, right? There's like five of them right next to each other, all separate grapes. This is a really strange analogy that I've chosen to open with. But, I mean, it's John Brooks on an island all on his own in terms of quality right now, or at least our perception of his quality. And then you've got Tim Ream, who I think is probably the backup at that left center back spot slash assistant to the assistant coach, maybe in that group. And then you've got on the right center back spot, you had Aaron Long. Now he's not in the picture. You've got Matt Miazga, Chris Richards, Walker Zimmerman, maybe Miles Robinson, some other MLS folks in there potentially. But Richards is the most talented player in that group. He's not at John Brooks' level right now, but his ceiling is higher than John Brooks' ceiling, in my view at least. He's already got 3 caps for the U.S. men's national team, but Berhalter's kind of been easing him in. He's played against Panama back in November, against Jamaica, and then Northern Ireland in March, but he only has 85 minutes across those 3 games, so he hasn't made any starts. He's come on in the second half all 3 times. I think his time to be eased along at this point is over, not necessarily because Berhalter was always going to go that route, but because this injury to Aaron Long has forced his hand. And I don't think the U.S. will be worse off having Chris Richards in that starting group. Taylor, I think you and I were advocating before that March window for him to be the starter against Jamaica and Northern Ireland in that window.
Yeah.
That didn't happen, but we've watched him at Hoffenheim. He's dealing with a little injury himself right now, a hamstring injury.
Right.
But if he's back and ready to go for the Nations League window, those 4 games, the friendlies surrounding the 2 Nations League games, I think he's ready to play. I think he's good enough.
The question I have is, if he's good enough for Bayern and good enough to get regular minutes at Hoffenheim, obviously you mentioned he's got a picking up a little injury at the moment, but why is it even a question of whether he would slot straight in?
I mean, I would argue he's not good enough for Bayern, which is why he's on loan right now and hasn't really played for them.
Got minutes though, didn't he?
Did he?
Some.
Maybe in preseason.
Yeah.
No, he's played this season, hasn't he?
A little bit. Mostly at right back, as far as I can recall. He wasn't a fixture there, right? And that's why he went to Hoffenheim. Ryan, I think to answer that question, sorry, Taylor, then I'll turn it over to you. I think the way Greg Berhalter looks at his players is less about what they're doing with their clubs, to be honest, and more about what they bring to his system and what he sees when he has them in for an extended camp. And I don't think he's in a real hurry to rush along young players and get them in the group. If he sees them as good enough and if he can work with them and get them in his system, then yeah, they're going to play. But that hadn't really happened, I guess, with Chris Richards before. I think it's going to happen now. Sorry, for stepping on your toes there, Taylor.
No, that's fine. I agree with you. I think it's probably also that, you know, he's a youngster. There's other established players in those positions or that have been in those positions for a while under Berhalter. And there is an idea, much as fans don't love it, that if you have this established hierarchy to bring somebody in and have them vault to the top of that or near the top of that, it's going to ruffle feathers. And it also then creates instability if that's not the kind of permanent arrangement. Then it gives players that feeling of like, well, can anybody come in any given moment? Does it matter what I've done in the past? And I think it's a really delicate line you have to walk in terms of upsetting the order. With the injury to Aaron Long, I think it's a clearer path for sure. Joe, my question back to you, though, is I think of Aaron Long as like, not to say John Brooks is slow or not mobile, but I think of Aaron Long as being the more sort of covering center back in that partnership, the one that can close down ground a little bit faster. Does Richards have that ability as well in your mind?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he's like Aaron Long and John Brooks had a baby, kind of how I think of him. He's versatile. He's mobile defensively. He can cover in behind for John Brooks, but he can also pass the ball like John Brooks can. Richards is right-footed instead of left-footed, but he even has a pretty strong weak foot as well. So he can kind of do it all. I don't have a lot of doubts that he'll be able to cover for Brooks physically. There might be an experience level that's missing there between him and Long, but as far as ability-wise, yeah, he can cover that ground.
That's going to be a tall, athletic, and bald baby.
Yes, it is.
If Long and Brooks had a baby, it would be a baby, though. It wouldn't be very good in defense, I'd suggest.
Ryan, you're right. That's a really good point. Darn.
I mean, I don't know. That baby could come out like 6 foot tall from birth. We don't know. We don't know these things,
right?
We have to wait and see what medical science can do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger had a kid. Isn't that the plot of Twins? It's not, but it should be.
Was that Twins or
Junior?
Junior.
Yeah, excuse me. I apologize.
Get
the
right,
other cinematic masterpiece from those two.
Oh, wonderful stuff. All right, I think that pretty much sums up the question. And thank you very much, Tyler, for that one. Why don't we move on to one? This is a pretty intriguing question from Monica Becker. How are player ratings determined? Your 10 to zeros, which you'll get on a number of websites and such. Is the rating completely statistical or is there a subjective element? Now, my immediate thought for this is it depends where you seek your ratings. It depends on which type of ratings as well. If you're talking like a newspaper column, for example, that's a subjective journalist opinion. But I presume what Monica is going for here is your daddy ratings, your whoscored.com ratings, where, you know, there's algorithms involved, there's Optostats involved. Joe, this feels like I could start off with you here. what do you got on this one?
Yeah, I went into the Who Scored archives, I guess. No, I just went on their website and looked.
Yep.
But you're wise to make that distinction, Ryan. There's a difference between the French newspaper rating, 0 to 10. It's arbitrary, yes. Right? It's based off of how someone looked at a game and what they decided. But for Who Scored, or I use FOTMob on my phone, more statistically inclined resources, Who Scored specifically uses an algorithm. From their website, ratings are based on a unique, comprehensive statistical algorithm calculated live during games. So they bring in a whole bunch of stats, and then they update that based off of if you're notching those stats or not, right? Are you completing passes? Are you completing dribbles? Are you executing those actions?
If Joe, do you have any idea what the number of raw statistics they utilize are?
Should we all say it at the same time? 200, right? It's a whole bunch. And I think probably a lot of that is just posturing on their part to make it sound more impressive than it really is. But it's not complicated, right? If you complete a pass, your rating's going to go up. If you have a pass that's intercepted, it's going to go down. But it is based in statistics, essentially.
I found it very interesting looking at the Who Scored, how they get to their numbers. As we mentioned, over 200 raw statistics included. We all read the same press release on that one. But how the ratings start at 6 and they move up and down from there. I thought that was very interesting. 6 is the base number. And that's more interesting when you look at the rating of the teams and the statistics, the top rated ones. If you go to whoscored.com/statistics, the top rated team is Man City with a 6.99 average. So Man City, the top team, only have an average 0.99 above the base rate, if that makes sense. The best player, the top player, according to the statistics, is Leo Messi with an 8.52 rating at the moment. And if you look at the top 10, they're all attacking players. 9 out of 10 are strikers. So I guess if you're going to look at the fallibility or the way these stats are put together, it seems like they lean towards attacking play a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that's why they try to add in the stuff about, like, they're weighted according to the influence within the game, because they're trying to make an argument that they look at the statistical data and utilize that, but then also they're looking at what the player did in the game. But I do wonder then how much they're looking at it, because if you have a weaker team where they have one heroic center back, like, diving into everything, but maybe that means he's only winning 4 of 8 challenges, then that statistically isn't going to be very good. So I think there are situations, at least in the past, when you had players who had consensus very good games that their player rating was not very good. And I think they've adjusted that a little bit. I think it's why, to answer the kind of overall question for me, I think it's that it's a blend of the two more than it's ever been. I think it's still very reliant on statistics, but I think there is some subjectivity to it as well, to try to balance things out and make it a little bit fairer, so that all positions are valued. Because I think historically, if a team concedes 3 and it's not the goalkeeper's fault that any of them are conceded, it's still 3 goals conceded. That goalkeeper gets really poor remarks as a result.
And these are flawed, right? This is a flawed system. Even really smart data analytics folks right now, they're thinking through ways to do this better. Over at American Soccer Analysis, they have a metric called goals added, and they're trying to create a more comprehensive, less subjective metric with goals added. It tries to measure the positive or negative impact on every single action, but it's still only actions, right? We're still missing this extra level in data right now, at least publicly speaking, where it allows us to look at what's happening off the ball. That's what we miss right now with a lot of data that's widely available. We can say, okay, I completed 100 passes and scored a goal, but how much does that really tell me about how effectively I influenced a game, right? Maybe it was a tap-in, and maybe those 100 passes were to a player that's 3 feet to my right. I mean, it still is a flawed way to look at it, and goals added does a much better job of using other numbers and pulling in other things as well on top of what places like Who Scored are able to pull in. But yeah, I just continue to caution folks. I think I've done this in the past talking about player ratings. They're a reference point, and I think it is dangerous to sometimes look too far into them.
They are a good reference point, and to sort of top line answer the question, they are based on an algorithm, but as Taylor says, there is a human element as well, because we can't let the machines take over. We've all seen Westworld. We know how this ends.
We do. Do either of you, like, I don't really use player ratings, and I'm wondering if either of you do and what you use them for.
I use Who Scored a lot because I use it to look at an individual player, like the breakdown of the ratings, what led them to that, that your interceptions, your shots, blah 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 blah. But I wouldn't actually use the actual figure, because it is just a top line reference, I think, as Joe says.
Yeah, I'll go into FOTMob and just click on the player, and it has the number on top of it, but I don't really pay attention to that. I do the same thing you do, Ryan. Okay, it's just a convenient way to get into some of the basic stats, passes, shots, tackle. Like, it's just an easy tunnel to get to what I actually want to see, which, again, still doesn't tell me everything, but at least it can tell me some things.
Did you all read about how L'Equipe do it?
No.
Oh, it's just a snooty guy who decides whether he likes a player or
six
not based on their
personality.
Snooty
guys.
Whoa,
snooty guys. Yeah, six journalists will give their marks for the French national team after its games. The paper's so-called official rankings will be an average of those scores. That's like a podcast I would listen to, is six Frenchmen arguing about if it should be a 7.7 or a 7.5. I feel like that would be very, very nerdy, but also pretty entertaining at the same time, and maybe lead to a fist fight or two, and I would enjoy that.
Taylor, I feel like we're on the same page on a lot of things, but I would set fire to that podcast and run away from it very quickly.
To each their own, my friend. To each their own. You can go on your own island. That's fine.
I won't be with the L'Equipe score givers, that's for sure, on my island. One other thing I did notice, or did sort of look into when trying to answer this question, gents, was I looked at other sources, and WhoScore.com uses a lot of Optadata, and I think Squawker use Optadata as well. But one thing I kind of looked into was FIFA game player rankings. It's not quite the 0-10 thing which Monica was asking about, but it's intriguing because I think a lot of people base their assumptions on players on those FIFA game rankings as well. And there's always this clamor to find out what player gets what ranking, blah, blah, blah. And I looked at how they come to those as well. And there's EA Sports have a team of, I think they say it's 25 EA producers, 400 outside data contributors who are led by a head of data collection, but also a community of over 6,000 FIFA data reviewers or talent scouts who are volunteers. So that feels a lot more of a fallible system to what WhoScored are doing to me. Much, much more complicated, lots more people involved, and volunteers giving their opinions, which feels like, have they really got the best model there? I'm not convinced, Joe.
I mean, let's just get the six French journalists to do it, right? I mean, I think that would be the best, most fair way, and they're just going to give N'Golo Kanté 99 everything, and I think there's value in that for all of us.
That's Ryan, which outlet was that again?
EA Sports. This is FIFA.
I feel like you're just building your like the England squad were frauded or defrauded campaign for when you don't agree with their player rankings.
Oh yeah, I've got a backup for everything like that. Don't worry. Don't worry. Okay. I'll blame the French, Taylor, because that's what we always go back to.
That also makes sense.
Thank you, Monica, for that question. That was a really good one. I had fun researching that one as well. We're going to be back very shortly with more questions.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. We've got some fantastic listener questions for this week, including this one from Kenneth Seiden, who says, what, if anything, can MLS do to better develop players that are in their early 20s that aren't getting decent offers from Europe for them to continue to get better to provide solid depth to the United States Mutant Ninja Turtles? Joe, I'll let you go on this one first. I've got some thoughts on this one. I've actually sought some outside consultation on this one as well. But Joe, let's hear what you've got to say.
Yeah, first of all, great acronyming there, Ryan. That is top-notch work.
It really does work. It works especially so well. because you're not, because it should be Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but we're talking about early 20s, so they are no longer teenage. So you remove that, and U.S. Mutant Ninja Turtles does make even more sense.
It works so
well. Done, Ryan Bailey.
This just all boils down to Alex Roldan being somehow a mutant ninja turtle somewhere in here. I think I actually am genuinely curious to hear what you fellas have to say, because I think there's a lot to be said here, or there really might not be. I think in your early 20s, as far as I can tell from watching players and watching games and occasionally being around players as well, there's still room to grow. There's still this technical development that you can go through, right? So if we're looking at ways for MLS and really MLS teams specifically in their own environments to continue to develop early 20s kind of guys, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24 guys that aren't ready for that jump and maybe are never going to be ready for that jump, but continue to elevate their quality to make them useful for the national team, there is still room to improve, right? You can still improve your crossing. You can still improve your passing, your weak foot. We saw that with Jordan Morris really well with the Sounders. His left foot is now not nearly the weak point that it was in the past. You can still do things to improve your understanding of space and tactics, and that goes across all ages, really. But the way I think about this question is actually less about, I guess, the individual player and more thinking that Major League Soccer needs to get better, right? That's how you really improve the overall baseline level of a player, is you improve the league, right? I see this as a rising tide lifts all boats situation. If Major League Soccer is improving and the individual teams are improving, more importantly, then the players that are in their early 20s but not ready for that jump yet are going to be more useful to the national team. I mean, am I way off on this, Taylor? It feels like improving the level will improve the players along with it, or those players really won't be involved anymore.
I mean, I don't think you're way off. I think I am a little bit more inclined to say that it isn't just a Major League Soccer issue. I think if you look at the way clubs around the world, or a lot of clubs around the world, want to operate, it's they want to bring in as young a player as they can to develop them in the way that the club wants to play and the style they want to play, while still emphasizing the sort of raw abilities of the given player. But I also think they'll bring in the 25-year-old if they're that world-class player for that next level amount of money. But to some extent, I think it is the case around the world that like 20 to 24, if you haven't reached a certain level, can be a challenging period, because it can be seen as this player should have fully developed by this point. There's not as much we can teach them. So I think it's a strange age range in which the player is not at their like athletic peak yet. But in some ways, I think the way we value players puts them at a disadvantage. And so if you are a 22-year-old player for, let's say, the Seattle Sounders, I think there's people will look at that player as being like, oh, they're not necessarily like that top tier elite player for the Sounders. Let's say they're a quality role player. I'm talking about a specific player now. Like, I think even if that player does well, there's still going to be an idea that they haven't reached that next level. They're not like some like otherworldly talent that requires a move to a stronger league. And I think to some extent, the way fans see players also factors into this. I think players can work really, really hard. I think it's an individual thing. I think stability on the coaching front and on the organizational front allows that player to continue to play in a system for 4 years. And I think that puts them in a much stronger position to develop certain skills and necessary skills. But I think there's a lot of other components involved, and it's a kind of common issue in my mind.
I think there definitely are a lot of components involved to this question. And when I first saw it, guys, I thought, my initial thought was MLS are doing something about this. They have done something specifically with these youth under 22 player slots that they formally introduced for 2021, which is basically you can bring in three more players. They can be paid anything that isn't above the maximum salary budget charge, and basically taking a subsidy from the target allocation money, blah blah blah. Easier for you to get younger players onto your roster is the reasoning for that rule. But then I looked into it a little more, and it turns out that's largely not going to benefit necessarily domestic players. There'll be a lot of foreign players who are going to benefit from that under 22 player slot. So that's not the answer to this question. And when I thought about it a little more, I thought it was maybe you got to do the work before they hit their early 20s. It's getting in the work before they hit that age. It's more academy growth, which to an extent is something that's happening a lot in the league as well. You know, an emphasis on young talent, an emphasis on players coming through, so you don't hit that issue when players are already at their early 20s. And I actually reached out to someone who I thought might have some perspective on this question. I reached out to a guy called Mark Nichols, who's a technical director at Charlotte FC. He also built the Seattle Sounders Academy. And his answer was one that I thought not too dissimilar to what Joe was saying, but more on an individual basis. He said to get those players to be, develop in their early 20s and to get them more solid depth for the USMNT, you have to play them. It's quite obvious. You have to play them, he said. He said, you make a plan for them. You look at the long-term potential, their positional potential. He says, you hold them accountable. And Mark says, you provide them with development plans and additional support. So basically, it's give them attention, play them, give them minutes is what the pro in this situation is saying.
Which I think makes a lot of sense because to provide better solid depth to the U.S. men's national team is, to me, a secondary thing. It's the effect, if not necessarily the cause. And if a player's playing really, really well, then they're going to get called in. Then they're going to get looks from Berhalter at national team level. But to do that, yeah, Ryan, absolutely. They have to be played. They have to be back. They have to get the opportunities. And to some extent, I think they have to have visibility. When I think about how we market domestic talents in Major League Soccer, it is either established national team players that will bring people into the stands, or it is up and coming potential national team stars. And you can't really like hype journeymen necessarily, but like there's like I look at Matt Turner, who is a good goalkeeper, but the way Twitter talks about him is as though he is the greatest goalkeeper alive. And there's something to be said for sort of getting that like organic hype around a player, even if it's like inflated or even if it's a little bit over the top sometimes. I think it helps establish that player's reputation. And to me, it does go back a little bit to the way we talk about these players, the way we cover them, the way we perceive them. I think there's a dismissiveness at times to some of the players that we're talking about of this range and this ability, that if we look more at like, oh, Giassi Zardes does this, this, and this, and this, and this, that's why Greg Berhalter likes him, as opposed to he's just bad, I don't like that guy. I think there's more opportunity for players to get looks, to be in that conversation without it immediately being, he's not good enough, we shouldn't even have him. If he's even involved, things are terrible. And that does, in my mind, tend to be the way things go with some of these names.
Well, and I also think, going back a little bit to what Ryan, you were saying, talking about what Mark Nichols brought to this dialogue, I think part of this also from an MLS perspective is just time, right? If you look at where the league is in their growth, and looking specifically at the development of youth players. So that's kind of what we're talking about here, right? Developing talent that then becomes, you know, these players that are no longer teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, they're just Mutant Ninja Turtles. We want this golden age range of when players are just entering their prime, and there's going to be some guys left over that aren't going to Europe or that aren't quite at that level, but you still need them to be at a high level. And I think as we see MLS continue to lean more and more into youth development initiatives, and they're trying to do that, right? We're seeing markets like Dallas, they're just the token example that comes to mind, develop homegrown players. And there are cap allotments made there for teams that develop talent and label them as homegrown players. So I think we could be entering a stage, and maybe this is still 3, 4, 5 years away, where there just naturally is more, number one, more talent in their early 20s, more American talent that have been developed through the homegrown initiative. But then number two, they're just players that are left that haven't gone over to Europe, and their level's going to rise as the league naturally improves. So I think part of it could just be waiting for MLS to hit that development cycle. Not that there doesn't need to be proactive movement and action accomplished during this waiting period, but it might have something to do with where the league is at in its life.
I think this is all very insightful, and this is wonderful answers to Kenneth's question. But while you were talking there, Joe, you've just prompted me to come up with the real solution to this question. Do you guys remember NFL Europe?
Oh, yeah.
It's what we actually need
to
do. The
rapid fire, baby.
Yeah. was it late 90s? I went to see some games at Charlton and Tottenham of some NFL Europe games. It was a whole thing. But we need MLS to make MLS Europe. So we'll move over to get some MLS teams in Europe, maybe even start a league there, a pan-continental league, like a super league of sorts. Then those players are in Europe. They're under the noses of these European teams. I don't know where I was going with this, but basically it's the answer to the question.
Boo, Ryan. Boo.
Get some decent offers from Europe because it gets them over there. Isn't that half the problem here?
Yes, that is definitely the problem. The lack of a Super League. Ryan Bailey on record is supporting the Super League. I think that's what we should take away from this episode.
That's the second sound.
Yeah.
Thank you for indulging my ridiculous answer there, Kenneth Seaton, to your question as well. Thank you very much. Let's move on to another one here from Taylor Judd. This is a good one as well. COVID restrictions have lifted and it is 100% safe to travel. That's not a statement. That's a theoretical that Taylor is presenting for this question. What city do you visit for 1 week to see both the best soccer and have the best vacation experience this summer? And Taylor would like an American and an international choice, s'il vous plaît. I got some options here. Taylor, mm-hmm. I'll go to you first.
All right. And I will take us down a bummer of a path first to say that I had a lot of answers to this question. And then I wanted to do a South American one because we have Copa America. There's a couple of different cities that are hosting events in Colombia. So I reached out to Felipe about which city would be the best to go to. And his response was, in Colombia right now, none of them, because it's still very, very bad there in Colombia. It's very bad in most of South America. So I think I sort of have this like, oh, I've had my second dose and like Virginia just made like masks optional, like, oh, we're doing fine, forgetting that it's still a pandemic that's raging. So with that bleak reminder in mind, I will say maybe not Cali, which was going to be my answer. I will instead say two strange ones, or at least one strange one, maybe. I'm going to go with Kansas City and I'm going to go with Amsterdam. Those are my answers.
You want to expand on that a little bit?
Nope, that's it. That's all I want to give. Yes, I will. Amsterdam or Glasgow. That's the other one. Because Amsterdam from June 13th to June 21st, you get to watch the Netherlands play Ukraine, Austria, and North Macedonia in the European Championship. Or you could do Glasgow and watch. First of all, Ryan, how am I supposed to pronounce that city? It's not Glasgow, right?
No, it's not Glasgow or Moscow. It's Moscow and Glasgow, darling.
There we go, Glasgow. You could watch Scotland play the Czech Republic. You could watch Croatia play the Czech Republic, and you could watch Scotland play Croatia. You'd also be there for Scotland playing England away, and that might be better if there's no like sort of focal point for the frustration if things don't go well. So that's my international choice. And then for Sporting KC, I would say you could get to watch them play Colorado and LAFC in 1 week, or you could go to Kansas City from July 11th to July 18th, and you'd be there for all three Gold Cup group stage games for the United States, and then you could eat some barbecue along the way as well.
Taylor, that's excellent reasoning and logic, but please don't tell anyone to go to Glasgow unless they have to. Not for a vacation, certainly.
Really? I've always wanted to go to Scotland. Scotland is on my list.
Oh, Scotland is very beautiful in many places.
Just not Glasgow?
Not so much.
That's how Granby said that.
Oh, you can tell Graham.
Graham's house, actually living on a construction site. Yeah,
yeah. The construction site around Graham's house and his house is lovely. I'll say that for the record. Joe, how about you?
Well, I'm going to LA first for my American experience because I kind of leaned into the best soccer. You know, Taylor wants to see the best soccer and have the best vacation. And one of the marquee games, I think, in MLS over the summer in terms of quality is going to be LAFC versus NYCFC. That's on May 29th. So if we're going to extend this out for a week, then you can also go a week early on May 22nd and catch LAFC and the Rapids. LAFC have started off poorly this year, but they still play really nice soccer. Maybe you'll get to see Carlos Vela if he's back from whatever injury problem he's dealing with. I think you get to see Bank of California Stadium, which I've heard is very beautiful, and it looks great on TV and on the broadcast. So it feels like a good spot, kind of a chip in for a shoe in for a vacation, and you get to see some good soccer as well. And then international, we're going to London, everybody, the end of the European Championships, July 6th to July 11th. Toss a couple extra days on there to see some sights. On the 6th, you get the first semifinal for the Euros, the second semifinals the next day, and then the final is July 11th. So, I mean, tournament soccer is always a little bit wacky. But you know, it's endearing in its own way. You get to see some great players and see some great moments. Plus, you get to see London, or at least parts of London. I think that sounds like a good one.
That's an excellent answer, because London in July, there's a very, very small window where it won't rain every day. And if you look at sort of early July, then you're kind of in that pocket. And as you say, two round of 16 games at Wembley, two semifinals and a final as well. That would be a strong contender for me to visit. And when I was looking at this question, I looked at a few options. Like Taylor looked at a Copper America visit, but I did find the similar issues that Taylor found, and also it's quite spread out because it's in Argentina and Colombia, and no, it doesn't seem like many cities have a concentration of games. Looked at Tokyo for the Olympics, but that too is quite spread out. It's in Kashima, Saitama, Sapporo, Sendai, and Yokohama as well. That's quite a lot of travel. It's not one city visit, although, you know, bucket list for me, Tokyo. I'd love to go there one day. And looking at American cities, I looked at maybe Vegas, because Vegas is Vegas and it's awesome. And you've got the Gold Cup final there. I think that would be a good one, but it's only one game to go and see there. Orlando, because you might get Toronto and Orlando matches there. Is that a good enough reason? You get a lot of matches.
You do. You have to be in Orlando, though.
Yeah? Do you not? You're not a fan of the Mouse House?
I mean, to paraphrase The Guardian when talking about Coventry, Orlando, in my mind, is the city that put the words concrete and nightmare into the phrase concrete nightmare. Is that good? No, I mean, it was mostly, I think I was last there in July, where everything was spread out because of MLS All-Star. And so, yeah, you had the drive all over the place. It was very hot. It was very humid, despite there being very little water around. So I think that's definitely part of it. And yes, there is also the idea of like the giant looming corporations all over the place. That does make me slightly awkward / uncomfortable.
You also might get eaten by a gator at some point, or at least share a room with one at some point in Orlando. So that's a fair concern as well. But I actually think I might have cracked this one. Oh, one other option, by the way, Portugal, because eventually every game's going to be there anyway. And Portugal's a really nice place for a vacation. It's beautiful. I think the answer I found in AFC Asian World Cup qualification, which takes place this June. I got to this because I was looking at what Australia are doing. Australia aren't actually going to Australia because it's quite draconian, the COVID entry requirements at the moment. They're based in, it's either Saudi or Kuwait, I think. They're playing four games, Australia are, in June in Kuwait. And if you go to either Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Dubai, or Guiyang, South Korea, you can get an eight-game AFC fill within June. So you can see eight international games in either one of those places. And say what you want about, you know, Bahrain, Qatar, Dubai and their political stance, but Dubai is very nice for a vacation. I've done it myself before. You can go to Dubai and see eight AFC games. Nice vacation. Some teams you probably haven't seen before from the AFC World Cup qualification. A new experience for you. I've won. Did I win? What do I win?
Not since Fox went with the "say what you will about Stalin" has somebody hand waved an entire like horrific practice with "say what you will about them." Now I'm going to say you did not win. I would personally rather just go to Amsterdam. Amsterdam is my vote, even if it's for my own vote. Joe, what was your international one?
Mine was London. Mine was London. It doesn't really matter what you guys say because you're both being exiled to islands, right? So you can't actually go on these trips. This is not for you. This is for Taylor Judd.
Okay, that's fair. Well, I did get confused there for a moment when you said it's for Taylor.
Yeah, I went full name on that one.
We've all discovered we want to go to different places. That's interesting. We didn't all reach a consensus. I thought might win you over with the promise of some AFC games. Evidently not, though, gents.
Kuwait, maybe. I could go to Kuwait. I've never been to Kuwait.
Kuwait's where the Australian games will be as well. So you could certainly consider that one. That would be interesting. That's a good question from Taylor, though, wasn't it? I really enjoyed that one. We are going to take a couple more questions from you guys after these short messages. Do stick around.
This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs, who would like to remind you when you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. You don't want to end up with Ryan, Graham, and Joe. Just kidding. Just kidding. Very much just kidding. Because I was very fortunate to have the three of them all join the show. And I had existing relationships with all three of them that allowed me to know that they could handle the amount of work that would be required, that they could be diligent in their tasks and be very effective on mic. And all three of them are. But again, that's because you have the existing relationship. If you don't feel like you have that with potential hires, then LinkedIn is going to make it very, very easy, and they're going to make it feel like you're connected to that person. They have a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire because it gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. But when you are setting the requirements and making it very specific as to what you're looking for, you can very quickly narrow it down to find the right candidate for that position. Hiring is easy when you have that many candidates, so easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. And LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring, and you can too. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/TSS. That's linkedin.com/TSS to post your job for free. Terms and conditions do apply. Thank you very much to LinkedIn for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. Couple more questions from you guys, including Robert Cordova, who asks, how did Sporting Club de Portugal win the Portuguese League? Simple one here. They got more points than the rest of the team in the league. What's next? Michael Thompson, yep. He asks, mm-hmm. No, I'm being silly there. Well, let's answer that in a little bit more detail, because Sporting Lisbon, as I like to call them, and all English people do for no particular reason, despite that not being their name, they ended a 19-year title drought. They last won it in 2002. They won it with a game to spare ahead of course, Porto and Benfica. They also won the League Cup this season. They very much were not the favourites to win this league at the start of the season. For one thing, a lot less financial clout these days than Porto and Benfica. Joe, let's go to you first. How did they do it? Tell us.
Yeah, there's a whole lot to unpack here, and I'm sure we will. So I'm just going to try to take a small bite. One thing that I think is important, especially looking at, you know, how are Sporting able to punch above their weight relative to the other giants at the top of the Portuguese First Division, they crashed out of the Europa League early on. They crashed out in their playoff in October. I believe it was on October 1st. And then immediately after crashing out, they started crushing it. Well, they'd already been crushing it, but they continued crushing it in the league. They went under this incredible unbeaten run, and they didn't break that streak until a 4-3 loss to Benfica on Saturday after they'd already won the league. So their unbeaten run stretched across almost the entire season. I don't think that happens without dropping out of another major European competition. You can focus more on the league. You can focus more on getting your best players fit to play on Saturday, and then Saturday, and then Saturday, as opposed to having to rotate between Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday, Thursday, whatever it is, right? It's easier to focus on one job, and Sporting had the weird ability, I guess the weird bonus of being able to focus almost solely on the league and then toss in the cup as well.
So this is like the Leicester and the Chelsea winning the league most recently option as well. Not being in Europe, going out the cups early, focusing. Is that what you're saying, Joe?
I think there's benefit in that, right? I think there's tons of other factors here, and I invite you guys to bring up some of them. But that's got to at least be mentioned in this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Taylor?
I would agree with that. I think that is a huge one, that like you don't have those distractions, you don't have the fixture congestion that leads to fatigue, that leads to injury. I think Joe's absolutely right. For me, I kind of did not know the situation with Sporting Club de Portugal, that I completely did not know that they had not won it since 2002. I kind of always assumed it was like Benfica, Porto, Sporting, all sort of rotating. Occasionally one is dominant for a while. I didn't realize it had been this long.
Did you assume that Ronaldo won it for the 5 minutes he was there?
Yes, I did. I also kind of forgot that this was the team that had the fans attack the players, that had contracts get canceled. It's why Rui Patricio is Wolves goalkeeper, is because of that incident, and he left. I think there ended up being a small amount of compensation, but certainly not what it would have been otherwise. So this was a club that were in a pretty considerable amount of disarray, and that extended until about March of 2020 when they appointed their current manager, Ruben Amorim. And that is another big one for me. He is currently only 36 years old at time of recording, so even younger when first appointed, had only been a top flight manager for 2 months. He'd been managing Braga. And for all of that, Sporting Club de Portugal paid the third highest release clause, I think is what I saw. It was 10 million euros at the time. It's risen to 14.4 million since. But that was because I think they identified a young manager who was going to come in with a specific philosophy and style. And from some of the things I read, it sounded like, and that wasn't wholly dependent on the players that he had, the quality of players, that is. He wasn't looking for, I need this type of striker for this amount of money. I think he was kind of willing to work with what was there, or certainly with aspects of what was there. They did sell a lot of players. They did move a lot of players on. They did bring in other players. But I think he was one of those managers who wasn't seeing big club equals tons of money to go around. And I think that was part of his appeal. But then his style, his philosophy, and his approach to man management, I think also of fundamental importance to this championship result.
Yeah, I think that was where my answer kind of led me as well. Almost Moneyball-esque in some ways, mm-hmm. this Sporting Lisbon title, in that they, as we've said, they didn't have the financial clout of the other big teams there. But it looks like they've sort of targeted a lot of youth players and also mixed in a little bit of experience as well, and gone for the kind of players who might not have been sought by other teams. Almost Leicester-esque in that way. And you look at like Pedro Conchalves, who's the top, a joint top league scorer in the Liga NOS this season, who was temporarily at Wolves and didn't cut it there. Not kind of a headline grabbing player before the season. And I actually looked into how much Mr. Mendes had a hand in this team as well, as I figured he might. And the answer is not a lot. He's got a lot of bigger players on Porto and Benfica, to be honest. He's got a few players like Rodrigo Fernandes on Sporting Lisbon and a couple of lesser players as well. But that wasn't the answer there. But it seems like, a really targeted recruitment process they've gone through here, and relying on having a very good defense. They only conceded 19 goals so far this season, or in this season, a plus 41 goal difference. And as we know, defenses win titles.
I mean, they do, but I think attacks definitely help. Joe, what were you going to say? Because I want to talk about the attack, but you are welcome to talk about whatever you want first.
No, please go attack, and then I'll pipe in.
Sure, because I think part of the way they're able to be so defensively solid is because of the way they set up, which is theoretically a 3-4-3. I would go with much more of a 5-2-3 from everything I have seen and from a lot of what I read and watched. And that front three, usually Nuno Santos, Pedro Gonçalves, and Paulinho, or also frequently Thiago Tomás. But three of those four were all brought in this summer. To Ryan's point, Pedro Gonçalves for $7.7 million, I believe. Nuno Santos for even less at $4.4 million. Both of those players now, if they were to be sold, would be sold for probably 10 times that, because they've been so strong this season. But that unit, the number of minutes they've had together, it allows them to press the way they want to. And those front three are sort of defending from the front by trying to defend as a tight three, and they push their opponent to one side, and then they can lock them in and sort of try to force the turnovers from there. So it's almost defending from the front by having such a tight unit that plays together so often. I think it's like 31 appearances and 29 appearances for three of those four. So on the whole, you've got a really unified team that then work together as a unit to win games and not concede goals.
And I think, yeah. Taylor, speaking to that point, I saw a lot of that 5-2-3 shape that you're talking about, especially defensively. I think Amorim kind of pulled a Thomas Tuchel, or at least that's the parallel I'm going to draw here, in terms of you come to a new job, and Amorim came to Sporting in a little bit of a different situation than when Tuchel goes to Chelsea. But you come into a new job and you don't try to reinvent the wheel. You come in with an idea of how you want to play, but you don't overcomplicate things. It just so happens that the shape is the same with Tuchel and his 3-4-3, and then Amorim and his 3-4-3. But the idea, I think, is more important than the actual formation. It's we're going to come in and we're going to play a logical style where players have defined positions. Yes, they can rotate. Yes, they can move. But we're going to keep things pretty simple. He threw in a tweak occasionally. From what I saw, there was a 3-4-3 diamond, almost Cruyff-style midfield at one point, but the dominant shape in possession was that 3-4-3. And then defensively, it naturally falls back into a 5-2-3. Force the ball wide, deal with crosses with those center backs, and don't give up goals. It was a pretty straightforward recipe from Amorim, and it worked. Yeah, they overperformed their XG, and they probably...
Yeah.
I think the odds of them winning this again, pretty low, unless they can continue to elevate the squad, which is possible, right, with good recruitment. But still, setting the underlying numbers aside, the tactical blueprint, I think, was strong and logical. And maybe those two adjectives are the most important ones you could have for a new coach coming into a pretty new situation.
I would add, besides this question, and building on Taylor Judd's question about which city to go and watch soccer in, Lisbon would be very high on my list, by the way, because traditionally the two clubs, Benfica and Sporting, have produced some of the best players like ever, basically. I don't know if you guys have ever been to Lisbon, but there's a highway, I think it's called the E1, where you sort of drive down it, and on your right, you've got the José Alvalade Stadium, the Sporting Stadium, and you go like a mile and a half further down it, and on the left is Benfica Stadium. It's weird. This one highway has two gigantic stadiums on either side, and it's a very, very cool city. Portugal is one of my favorite places in the world. So I will just add that if you've never been and you want to do a little trip somewhere in Europe to see some games, there's a much worse place to go than Lisbon.
I appreciate that. I've never been to Portugal, and that is certainly on my list. And I'd like to see both those stadiums. So there you go. Joe, you as the dictator of Porto, I was then wondering, like, is it also the case that Porto and Benfica have been particularly poor? And we may have sort of already answered this, but do you think it is the case that a lot of this, in terms of why they haven't been able to pick up some of the results maybe they normally would, do you think a lot of it is just that they've been in European competitions with Porto going maybe a little bit deeper than we would have expected? Do you think that impacted their ability to be competitive on multiple fronts?
I think that's a lot of it, right? And I'd be lying if I said I'd done deep dives on all of these teams, but that has to play a part, right? Taylor, you talked about it, the rotation and the extra minutes leading to injuries, leading to difficulties within a squad. That plays a toll on you over the course of a season, especially with Porto and the run that they made. But also, I mean, it's not as if Sporting has run away with the title. For as good as their unbeaten run was, they're not 10, 15 points clear at the top of the league right now. They have a couple point lead over Porto and another few points over Benfica, but they're not miles ahead. I honestly think this sounds so nerdy, and I'm pushing on my glasses as I'm saying it. I think if the XG numbers, I would bet, I didn't look at them, but I bet the XG numbers probably reflect better on Porto and Benfica than they do on Sporting, which maybe over the course of a few seasons will level back out again, and we'll see that hierarchy kind of shift back to where it's been. But again, that's kind of up to Sporting on how they want to build the squad going forward.
Mm-hmm. Then the only other wrinkle I had seen about why Benfica might not be as strong is because they were starting Jan Vertonghen and they were not starting Ruben Dias, who was sold in the summer. And there's an argument to be made that he was so important to that team. We've seen how good he's been for Manchester City, that losing this sort of rock in defense really impacted Benfica's ability to stay strong and competitive throughout.
Agreed. I think one of the reasons Porto haven't done well, I'd add, is because Sergio Conceição keeps playing his own son, and nepotism only works if you're a recent Republican president. I think that's what's been shown. Any more on this one before we move on to the final question, gentlemen?
Just, I'm really excited to see what happens next, man. Because with everything that they went through for Sporting to be able to win this title the way they have, and as Joe said, I think they're overperforming on their own expected goals as well as goals, like expected goals conceded or whatever that would be. I think on both fronts they're overperforming, so maybe that means they crash back down, or maybe that means before that happens Ruben Amorim breaks another transfer record when he moves to, say, Tottenham.
Did you see the video last week of Ronaldo's mum celebrating Sporting's win?
No.
They were like out on a patio or some restaurant or something, and the mum and the whole family would going nuts with Sporting's win in what may have been a carefully staged video to show the family support for that club, given maybe he might go back there at some point in the next year or two. Interesting, I thought.
I don't see how they could afford him, number one, and I don't see how he makes that team better, aside from just being Ronaldo. But the way they play, he does not fit the style. It's sort of the problem Juve had with Maurizio Sarri coming in, is that Ronaldo doesn't really fit what he wants to do. I'm not sure Ronaldo fits what they're doing right now, but he is still Ronaldo. He is a big draw, so I guess we'll see, and especially if it's going to make his mom happy. Maybe that's an important factor for Sporting as well.
Yeah, he's going to decide he doesn't want to do it for the money anymore, just for his mummy. Mummy, not money. is going to be the way he goes in the next year or two. We shall see about that. Robert Cordova, thank you very much for that question. One last one from Michael Thompson, who says, in 2020, the five substitutions rule made sense due to compressed schedule around the world. In 2021, the case is less clear, but MLS seems to have moved forward with little hesitation. Do you think European leagues may do the same this fall? And could the five sub rule be here to stay? Joe, five sub rule, where you can basically change 50% of your outfield team. What do you think?
I think it could be here to stay. I gather from your tone, Ryan, that you might not be a huge proponent of this rule. Maybe I'm over reading into that. But I think it could be around for a while, and by a while I mean forever. As teams are playing more and more games, which has happened even though we're out of the period of time where we've had games canceled or a lot of games canceled and you're having to make all of them up, there still are a ton of games, right? And we're seeing more with, even though the Super League didn't happen, we're seeing more little competitions pop up, especially here in the United States. MLS and Liga MX are constantly trying to further integrate themselves into each other, and that leads to more games and more little random tournaments. The Champions League in Europe is going to be expanded. The CONCACAF Champions League is going to be expanded in a couple of years. So my thoughts on this is, yeah, it does change a lot of what's happening on the field, but it doesn't disrupt the flow of the game. It's still the same three windows. I think for the sake of benefiting the players and aiding their health, I think it kind of makes sense. But I think I'm generally for it because it doesn't really change a whole lot, at least not in terms of how I watch games.
I think you've definitely got some good points there, Joe. And the pros are, it is good for player welfare. You know, we have players playing 60 games a season and or more, and that's too much. And this could certainly help ease that. I also love chaos. And when you can change 50% of your team, that can encourage that kind of thing. But I think one of the reasons, I think it may come in across Europe, but maybe not all European leagues, because there is an argument that it disproportionately helps bigger teams with stronger squads. If you're Man City and you've got a ridiculous bench, it helps you more than if you're Burnley, frankly. And it might encourage teams to stockpile for this very reason. And if you look at the Premier League, I think it's several times they've voted against the five subs. And most recently, I think it was December, they chose not to do it. And the way the voting went, it seemed as if it was the majority of teams voting against it, not the big six teams who may benefit from the having five subs. And if you look at big six teams and maybe getting their own way these days after what they tried to pull, I'm not sure they're going to get many more decisions going their way, certainly not from the majority of other Premier League teams helping them out. So in the Premier League, I'm not sure it will be here to stay, but I could see it potentially happening in some other leagues. Taylor?
I mean, I think I'm of two minds here. I think I like the idea because it does allow you more opportunities to sub players, especially if you do have injury concerns. If there's a concussion issue, to have that extra luxury of getting a player off, obviously it does then take one of your sort of allotted three periods when you can make those changes. But I think there are reasons why it's a good idea. I also think there are reasons why it could really be quickly abused, especially if you have larger squads. If you're letting the match day squad be 23 instead of 18 or whatever it might be in your respective league, like, then you are going to have those bigger clubs spend more money knowing that they can just add more depth. And it sort of defeats the purpose in allowing you to spread around the minutes and make sure you're doing some load management. It just allows you to sign more players. There's a reason why Chelsea, who signed 35 attackers or so last summer, voted for in favor of this. It's because they want to be able to have more options and keep more players happy. So I think there's like a cynical side that would take advantage of it, and I think that there's a positive side in which this could be very useful. My strange thought experiment that I would throw out to you two, and I'm happy for you both to say no, that's a terrible idea. Would, if we have different leagues saying, yeah, we're going to do five, if we had some leagues say, no, we're going to stick with what we want, or maybe some leagues go with four, what if they also instituted a third transfer window? Because that would, if you did one in the summer, if you did one in like November and then one in February, that would allow you to bring in players and not have it be an emergency situation. And you could do more short-term loans, things of that nature, which sort of solves the same problem to some extent. But I'm wondering if you all think that's an interesting way to go about it, or if you would just rather they increase the subs and stick with that.
Wouldn't the third transfer window have the same disadvantages in it? It would just help the bigger teams.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think it would also mean panic buying, which means you can really hold those bigger clubs hostage and try to get a little bit more money out of them, which would probably work. But also, yes, it does mean that they could then sign those players. I think I'm just looking at it as more of a, like, investigate all options before trying to cram in something that could be potentially problematic. But I guess I'm doing the exact same thing. So either way, it's going to be problems.
You're not part of the solution, Taylor. You're part of the problem.
I guess not.
I don't know, Joe. Have you got any thoughts on that one? It's an interesting thought experiment. And I think it's weird that we're going to probably have inconsistency across leagues. And I think we'll have a point where European pan-continental competition very much has five substitutions, but some of the leagues do not as well. And we'll have some disparity there as well. So I don't know if this one gets ironed out, because it's not naturally, it's not a 100% yes, this makes sense for 100% of teams situation.
Yeah, it's hard. There's no clear answer to what's best here, or at least we don't have one. Taylor, I like your idea. I'm not sure that it solves the problem, but I think it's fun, and I enjoy the thought experiment. I don't know how to fix this. I don't know. There is no way. I guess let me put it this way. There's no way to make this rule change equally benefit everyone, or no practical way that we'd ever see instituted. And so that makes approaching this question in the way that we're trying to, that would not just immediately benefit the Big Six and the Premier League, yeah, or whoever. It makes answering this question kind of impossible. And so I don't know what's going to happen. I do genuinely think that we'll see the five sub rule stay in a lot of places. Ryan, you're right. It might not be everywhere, but I wouldn't be surprised to see us all eventually, or to see all these leagues eventually get to that point at some point down the line.
Yeah, I think you're right, Joe. I think we'll see four or five or an extra allotment for injury, something like that. And I think it does become more permanent. I will be totally honest and say that I think part of this for me, I was very much in favor of the five sub rule, except that the way I take notes on games is I kind of try to write down everything that I can. And tracking 10 substitutions is a lot of substitutions to track, and figuring out who's gone where and who's playing where and when can be a little bit time consuming. And I think there's a self-interested part of me that's just like, I only want to have to track 6 instead of 10.
Your notes are beautiful, Taylor. Like, they're pristine.
Too much.
So
I don't want
soccer to overload you to the point where your handwriting starts to look like mine. So yeah, maybe we do need to go back to 3, everybody. This is top priority.
There was one game when I got the lineups totally wrong and had to redo it, and it's not pretty. It's not pretty. Oh, it's the champion. It's the Women's Champions League final of this past weekend, when two different sites had the lineups incorrect and I wrote them in pen, and it was a problem. So I'm blaming the substitutions rule for that as well.
So knowing how fastidious you are with the notes, Taylor, did you like put yourself in a cone of shame and spank yourself for a little while after messing it up?
I considered tearing the page out and restarting. Yes.
Okay. We're saying the same thing, basically. I will add that I can understand why MLS have instituted the five subs, and the league does like to jump on new things and try them out, and that's good for them to do. Does it work better in MLS because it's a closed system, less likely to stockpile, the way it would help elite teams? There's not quite as much disparity. Is that fair to say? It's better used in this
case? I think it's fair.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a big part of it, Ryan. And then, like, the other small percentage, I think, would be that Major League Soccer already has so many strange rules and permutations when it comes to roster and budget and general operation and charter flights versus non-charter flights that, like, I think there's more willingness to do strange things and go and, like, roll the dice on strange approaches, knowing that some will stick and some won't. But I do think when you have all of these odd stipulations in place, or seemingly odd stipulations in place, what's one more? Versus if you're the Premier League, where everything has to be a certain way and this is how it must be and we must all act accordingly, I think there's less inclination to experiment and try random things.
Oh, those stuffy Brits. Don't want to change their ways. Goodness me. I think that pretty much wraps up our listener questions show. Gentlemen, mm-hmm. It's been a pleasure. Listeners, thank you very much for indulging us on this one. Taylor Rockwell, a pleasure as always.
A pleasure as always to you, my friend. Listeners, I would say we were going to have the return of our scouting reports today. It has been way, way, way too long, and for that, I sincerely apologize. When I went to look at the scouting report document, there were many of them, but I think they all stopped in early to mid-April, which is fair since we haven't read them since, I think, 2020. So what I would say is I would encourage people to start sending them again if you do have a player you're scouting, and I promise that we're going to return to having scouting reports be parts of shows. I think if you had been sending them, I have kept that list. I'm going to go through and find all the people who did and find a way to make it up to you all for those reports not being read. And then I will also work on getting a system in place to assign players and get things rolling on that front as well. So lots of work to be done with the Scouting Network, but I do want to bring it back and make it great again. And now I realized I've just said that and I don't like it. So I'm going to say instead, we're just going to make the Scouting Network awesome. Thumbs up.
Are you going to make it up to them by giving them free access to Graham's OnlyFans?
I mean, if they want, but like, it's just so perfectly like erotic that I don't know if anything will ever live up to it.
And on that note, Joe Lowry, a pleasure to have you on the show today.
I don't have any TSS-wide announcements to make, so Ryan, I'm just going to say thank you for having me, and thank you for hosting and doing the wonderful job that you do.
Of course. Ta-ta for now!